Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tom Whiting, and he'll be answering your most important questions on hackle and feathers. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use our Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tom Whiting about hackle facts about feathers. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like shortline nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Tom, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. If you haven't registered yet, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Look for the link under Tom's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away, thanks to Tom and Whiting Farms, a Hebert Minor Gold Grade Brown Rooster Cape. Now, that's something that you'll all want to win, and you'll have to stay tuned, because here's how you win. You must be the first person to answer the question that we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we've talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on your homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills when the time comes. So we'll be asking that question near the end of the show. Our guest tonight is Dr. Thomas Whiting. Tom is president and owner of Whiting Farms, Inc., which he founded in 1989. The mission of Whiting Farms from its inception was to become the supplier of the finest fly tying feathers for tires of the world. Starting with the famed Hoffman Hackle, developed by Henry Hoffman of Oregon, Whiting Farms has grown to become the largest, most diverse source of quality tying feathers in the world. Currently, Whiting Farms offers 3 distinct lines of dry fly hackle. The first genetic wet fly hackle known as American Hackle, and a unique spay hackle, partridge substitute feathers, Coque de Lion feathers, and has a number of other fly tying feather lines in development. Thomas Whiting has been involved with poultry and game birds since around the age of 10. He further pursued his interest by gaining 3 university degrees in poultry science, Colorado State University, University of Georgia, and University of Arkansas, where he got his Ph.D. Whiting Farms is located in Tom's home state of Colorado. Well, Tom, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. Thanks for coming on our show tonight.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be here, Roger.
Well, tonight, folks, will be a bit different show. We've never done a show that is like this, but I found it, Tom and I got to talking over dinner at the last fly fishing retailer show, and in that conversation found out that there's just a lot of interesting things about his business, about how it got started, and about the feathers that we use every time we sit down at a vise. So I thought it'd make a great show, and so tonight we're going to talk a little bit about his business, the background of the business, some history around how this got started and how it's continuing to move forward, and how the chickens are raised. You know, what is genetics? How does it apply to chickens? And hackle itself, where we can learn about what types of feathers to get, how to recognize good grades versus bad grades, and which ones we should use when. So there's going to be a lot of interesting information that we're going to cover tonight. Well, first of all, Tom, let's talk about, you know, your business in general, because it's, you have to admit, it's a bit unusual. I mean, there's not that many people that do what you do in the world, is there?
No, I don't think there's more than a half a dozen people that are really in the hackle business, raising fly tying feathers at a material level. That's my understanding.
Well, then, at a high level, what exactly do you do at Whiting's Farms? Spell it out for the folks.
Well, it's a little bit surprising how complex it is. In fact, I wouldn't have believed how complex it was before I got in, but I've got a pretty quick education quickly. Anyway, it's surprisingly complicated. For one thing, it can't be a large company just because the world market isn't very large. But what are the challenges are you have to control things from the pedigree lines of birds, your breeding program, through the whole production cycle and process the pelts, grade them, package them, then you have to market them, and then you have to distribute them out to wherever your customers are in shipping or however you get it to them. And then you have on top of that all the regular challenges of a small business, you know, payroll and personnel and taxes and facilities and repair and maintenance and all those things. So it's a surprisingly complex business.
How many people actually work at Whiting Farms now?
Right now we're at 28 full-time personnel and a few part-times. So it's not a small operation. There's a lot of handwork in the trimming and skinning and packaging and grading and shipping. So it's fairly labor intensive, and that's why we have that many people.
Is there a cycle to this whole thing? I mean, are there chickens being processed every day, or are there certain times of the month or year that you do that? Or?
Well, Whiting Farms does things differently, or we did things differently from the start, and that's maybe one of the reasons we've grown the way we have. The other hackle producers were seasonal in that they had a large crop, say Metz did, and that they harvested in the fall, then they kind of shut down and prepared for the next year. I came from a poultry production background, so I saw that that wasn't very efficient. So what we do is we go year-round in as constant a manner as we can, producing birds, hatching out every week, every Friday's hatch day at Whiting Farms. We harvest every week. And so we're harvesting and putting product into our inventory at all times. But there is still some seasonality of the market. People like to tie their flies during the winter and get their preparations done for the next fishing season. So we do have a kind of winter-loaded market, although I've seen less and less winter loading in the recent years, and it's going more and more even year-round. So it's a full tilt business at all times, and frankly, if you got live animals, you rarely get a vacation.
Yeah, I know. When you were in Denver, you were a little anxious to get back right away. It seemed like to get back in motion again. And that's part of the farming and ranching business, though, isn't it?
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. Now, can you give us a little bit of history about the hackle business itself? When it started and how it's progressed through the years and where you came into the picture.
Okay, so you want something of the hackle industry history, is that right?
Yes.
Well, I wasn't around for a whole lot of it, but I've tried to educate myself pretty thoroughly about it. Raising birds for fly tying feathers is probably only 70 or 80 years ago it started, and mostly it was very devoted fly tiers who just couldn't get the feathers they needed, so they set about doing it themselves. And some of the early pioneers in the hackle business was Harry Darby of the Catskills. He was a very famous fly tire up there. And Andy Miner was another. And then there was people preceding them, but Andy Miner and Harry Darby were some of the first ones that got going in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And at that time, it wasn't really a business. It was more of a labor of love and a necessity to get some decent fly tying feathers. But in the 60s, a man named Henry Hoffman, I think around 1964, 65, wanted to get into the business because he was a commercial fly tier, and his parents had actually had a poultry breeding company. And so he sought around the different poultry fanciers and picked out some Barred Plymouth Rock Bantams, which is a little breed of kind of show chicken, and it had a great grizzly feather on it, and he was off and running, raising those for many years on a small scale at his parents' place and then his own place. and he got going, and he really developed the first genetic hackle that I know about. In the 70s, or really starting in the late 60s, but getting going in the early 70s, Buck Metz, or Robert Metz from Pennsylvania, got into it in a big way, and he came from a poultry production background, his family being a fairly large producer of meat chicken chicks, and they even had some layer chicks, Buck told me one time. And then Ted Hebert also got some of good foundation stock from Andy Miner Jr. of Minnesota, and started that, and then there were some other ones that have didn't come to the prominence but of those two, but still got into the hackle business. And during the 80s, or 70s and 80s, it was really dominated by Buck Metz, who was the first large-scale producer of dry fly hackle in the world. Henry Hoffman was doing his own higher-quality hackle production, but on a much smaller scale. And Ted Hebert was sort of something in the middle.
Now, were all three of those doing it scientifically, when you talk about genetic breeding and so forth at that point? Were they?
None of them were trained geneticists. Only Buck Metz was a poultry production person, having grown up in a family that was in large-scale industrial meat chicken production. Ted Hebert was just a curious fellow and just thought it sounded like a fun thing to do. Henry Hoffman really was motivated to develop this into a business. None of them had a great deal of genetic education, but I know from Henry's case, he did whatever reading he could, and I don't know what Buck Metz did. All of them, and this is one very interesting thing, having known all three of these and then some other hackle producers, they all had the similar goal. They wanted to breed dry fly hackle on the best they could, but the way they went about it was totally different. It couldn't have been more different. And it's been a sort of an educational thing for me to see and have these guys explain their work. And they couldn't have gone about it in a more different way, in both the genetic approach, their breeding programs or their production programs or their business programs. It was really, it's an interesting story that somebody ought to write about one of these days.
Well, you say in a different way from each other?
Yes.
Okay. So each of them was taking a different path.
Yes.
And then you came into the picture then what, in the late 80s, right?
Yes, I got into the business in 1989, in February, so I'm coming on 19 years. It staggers me to even say that. But it seems like yesterday, then it seems like a lifetime ago, too, you know. But and I got into it, and I had, fortunately, a pretty thorough education in poultry science, having 3 degrees, bachelor's, master's, and PhD. And I had a specialty in poultry genetics, which is a very rare specialty. And I'd even worked for 2 poultry breeding companies, genetic companies that are for the industrial type of chickens for meat or eggs. So I came at it with a fairly broad background. And then in my early days, I had Henry Hoffman helping me for about the first 4 or 5 years. He kind of shared with me his expertise, and I studied his methodology and went on and tried my own and developed it. But I also had the same benefit from Ted Hebert, who had a totally different method. I don't think the scope of the show would want to get into that, but they had different, almost diametrically opposed strategies and approaches. And how Buck Metz did it, I don't know. He's never really described that to me.
Now, are those three gentlemen all out of the business now?
Yes, they are. Henry sold the business to me, and after I had it up and running, he shut down his Oregon operation, but he's enjoying a nice retirement of fishing and tying flies, and I see him every couple of years. Ted Hebert is also out, and he's retired. Buck Metz sold to the Umpqua Company, which is a major fly tying company in the world, and the Metz organization is still going, although it's had a few different owners over the years. And I haven't heard from Buck's since he retired, so I assume he's just in retirement. I don't think he's involved in the company at all.
So Umpqua is actually in the same business that you are now as far as raising chickens?
Yes.
Okay. So, all right. And then I take it you took all this knowledge and took a little fresher path to your approach to the business.
Yeah, I definitely did. And as in many people's cases, serendipity played some good factors and good timing and things like that. When I got into the business, it was only a few years after the movie A River Runs Through It had come on, And, of course, that stimulated a lot of interest in fly fishing, and there was actually a shortage of hackle at that time. So getting in was good, and even if the first years were kind of screaming nightmares, to be honest, and I messed up a lot of good birds, I could still sell it to, like, the commercial fly tying company. So my timing was good, and we quickly learned. And I wanted to bring an approach to it that was different, and I should have done that anyway. I couldn't have just carried on with how these other people had done it, and I did that. But one sort of fortuitous thing is when I settled in western Colorado, there was a declining mink industry. And you think about it, production of fur animals has a whole lot of similarities with raising hackle. In both cases, they're an animal that has something of high value on the outside of them that have got to be kept in a cage by themselves. And the mink industry was kind of waning in the United States, not for lack of demand, but for the Russian economy coming on. And they have a cash, you know, it was a cash crop for the Russian economy when it went to a capitalist out of communism. Well, anyway, these mink businesses were shutting down, and I was able to buy them at pretty reasonable amounts of money, and they had cages on it. And at one time, I had three of the former mink ranchers working for me. And they brought an interesting perspective to growing birds that was similar to the mink industry. And I learned things from them. And one of them still works for me today. And it was an interesting, I wouldn't have predicted that or planned on it, but it was just something that was very fortuitous when I got started in the early days.
Where you keep your chickens now are on these old mink ranches, right?
Well, I've maintained two of them, but we build extensively onto them, and I've started a whole new other ranch that's much larger, and it has state-of-the-art modern chicken houses. But the mink guys had all their different cage designs and theories and how to bring the animal to prime. It was an interesting study, and they had different genetic programs for rotational breeding systems, and I actually learned quite a lot from them.
Now, to back up just a couple of steps here, how did you go? You were doing genetic work at the companies that were raising chickens for meat and other byproducts and so forth. How did you decide to make the move into the hackle business?
Well, that's a funny little story and one of these serendipity things. I was in graduate school doing my doctorate, and I had another business idea, totally unrelated to hackle or this kind of thing. And so I knew a man who had been in the hackle business named Dr. Kerry Quarles, and he had a hackle company called Colorado Quality Hackle. And this was probably during the 70s, and he was trying to get into the business. He only did it for about 3, 4, 5 years. I'm not sure how long he went. But anyway, I contacted him, being just on the periphery, knowing about his hackle business, and I had my other business idea. And so I contacted Dr. Quarles and said, hey, I've got something I'd like to try. Hey, or if you're not using your hatchery, can I buy the incubators or lease your hatchery for a while? Because we had a family farm not far from it. And he said, no, but I'll sell you the hackle company. And so I said, well, I don't know. But I took a spring break, and I went back to Colorado and visited with Kerry. And they had just gone through a rather torturous lawsuit with an incubator company where the incubator had malfunctioned, and they were claiming it had put them out of the hackle business or anything. Well, anyway, they had a stack of court documents in preparation for the lawsuit that probably stood about a foot and a half high. And the vice president of the company said, well, here you go. You want to know about the hackle business? And they pushed across this stack of papers. And so I read about that. And in it was all this information about the hackle business and the market, and they had expert witnesses, and Gary Borger had written a piece. It was quite extensive. And so I got through it, and even though I didn't buy the Colorado Quality Hackle stock, I learned enough about it to say, you know, this might be fun. And I'd always had a particular interest in plumage genetics to begin with and already done research on it on my own instigation, never knowing that I'd ever be in the hackle business. But it came in to be handy later on because I like shows.
I guess so.
So that's how I got into it, and the rest is history.
Well, then you said you didn't purchase their initial stock. Where did you get your first birds?
Well, in all these documents, there was a couple of names that were reoccurring. Metz, because they were the big leader in the hackle business at that time. Then Henry Hoffman, which they had tried to acquire and merge as one of their strategies to get that Colorado Quality Hackle Company going. he was always mentioned as having the highest quality in the unique dry fly saddle line that Henry had developed. And then Hebert was always figuring prominently also as a third contender in the newly defined genetic hackle world. And so I literally just called up information. Now, I think I called Kaufman's in Oregon, and they gave me the phone number of Henry Hoffman, so I called him up and just started developing a phone relationship with him. And then I contacted Ted Hebert via Gary Borger, I think. And I just started talking with these guys. And in both cases, they were trying to sell their business. And at one time, and this is a little-known fact, Henry Hoffman and Ted Hebert tried to put together a company. But the problem was neither one of them wanted to do the work. They just wanted to kind of get out. So it never materialized. And Henry had tried to sell his company for a number of years, and a lot of people wanted to invest in it and have Henry stay and do the work, but Henry wanted to get out. He wanted to take a vacation. So I was sort of the first guy to come along with wanting to do the work and having the background and education to do it.
So you purchased birds from both of those?
Well, I couldn't afford both. And Hoffman had the better quality, so I opted to go with Henry in the Hoffman hackle. And so I bought that exclusively, and now it had to be part of the deal. I got all of his birds, then he destroyed what he had in Oregon. And the way we transferred the birds was ship hatching eggs, because that's, frankly, the easiest way to do it than moving live chickens. So we just shipped out. He just put together his breeders in Oregon, and we shipped out, I forget how many eggs, and I think I had 5,000 or 6,000 the first year, and that was all I could handle.
So you got a bunch of eggs in the mail, and that's how you started business, huh?
Yeah. Well, it was FedEx, actually. But
FedEx. that's interesting. That's very interesting. So basically your business came out of the Hoffman line, which I remember from way back when I was a kid tying flies. So
that's right.
That's been around a long time.
Yes.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, Tom, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about hackle and feathers and all kinds of fun stuff. So hang tight here.
Okay, thanks.
Front Range Anglers, a full-surface fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tom Whiting about hackle and facts about feathers. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And we have received one question in tonight, live, Tom, but I'm going to hold that for a little later till when we start talking about the different types of hackle and so forth. So we'll address that in just a minute. Okay, you said you started out with about 5,000 eggs, which turned into chickens, obviously. And how many chickens do you have today on an average day?
Well, Roger, I should have gotten together and figured that out, and I really should know, you would think, but the fact that we hatch every week, which is adding birds to the system, and then we harvest every week, which takes them out, it's sort of a fluid number. But I think right now we're somewhere about 85,000, if I'm not mistaken, on the hoof, as we say, in the system. And that's going year-round, so we're taking them out and putting them in all the time.
That's a lot of birds.
It is.
That's a lot of birds. Well, now, you did, in reading some of your materials and so forth, it said you, I don't know how long ago this was, but you added the Hebert Minor line to the Hoffman line, right?
Yes, but I kept them distinct.
Kept them distinct. Okay. Why did you add that line, and what did it add to your business to enhance the products that you have now?
Well, that's a good question, and I'd love to tell people about it because it's sort of a confusing somewhat. The Hoffman line was very famous for its grizzly. Henry Hoffman, I think smartly, concentrated on making the best grizzly in the world, both in the Cape and in these unusual long dry fly saddles. He also developed a white and was working on a brown when I acquired the line. but he focused, and that's one of the reasons he was so good at the Hoffman Grizzly. Ted Hebert's line, which was derived out of the Andy Miner Jr. line, which also came partly from the Harry Darby line, so it's, if you want to look at it, I'm like the fourth custodian of it, and it's been in development for about 70 years. It was totally different. Instead of just being a narrow group of colors like the Hoffman Hackle line was, the Hebert was very diverse and had a rich, just a panorama of different colors, and they specialized in duns in particular, but every conceivable shade of dun. And they're a totally different genetic background. Hoffman was distinct, doing his own little thing in Oregon. The Hebert Miner, and I call it that because I got it from Ted Hebert, who got it from Andy Miner, and I guess I should call it the Darby Miner Hebert Whiting now. Well, anyway, it's a long lineage. They would get birds from, they would swap with people. Henry was very tightly cloistered in his operation, but the other guys, the other early hackle pioneers, were always swapping birds and trading eggs and trying this and going to poultry shows and driving down the road and seeing something good and stopping in and buying it. So it was a real diverse genetic origin, and that's where some of this range of colors came from, and that's what I liked. But it also, the Hebert, if I understand, I never met Andy Miner myself, but Ted Hebert's a very nice guy, and Ted told me that Andy and him got along great, and actually Andy gave him the best birds that he had. And it sort of looks like that from how good the Hebert line was compared to some of the other people that got Andy Miner's stock. Andy Miner was an attorney by training, but his love was in fly fishing and raising these hackle birds. He was much happier at home. I've talked to his son, who's visited here, and we keep in communication. And Andy just loved doing this. And he never sold a pelt, and he never sold a bird. He always gave them away. And he was kind of the Johnny Appleseeds of the hackle world, Andy Miner was. Well, anyway, Ted Hebert met him, went out there and got the birds from him, took them back to Michigan and started raising them there. And Ted Hebert did do a good job, though he wasn't any kind of trained geneticist. He was just a keen observer and endlessly curious, and he did a darn good job raising the birds and breeding them and bringing up the quality. So I wanted to have it. It also gave me some genetic diversity because the Hoffman line really only goes back to 6 or 12 individuals. It's sort of lost in the shadows of the past. Henry's not too sure how many they came out of. He, you know, mixed them up, but it really started with only a few. And so having two totally different foundation stocks to run a long-term company is very valuable. And you have some inbreeding relief there. You have some diversity, and without variability, a geneticist can't do anything. If there's no variability, then they're all clones, and unless you hope for a mutation, nothing's going to change. So that's the reason I acquired the Hebert Miner line in 1996, if I'm not mistaken. So I've had it about 10 or 11 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so now, when I'm looking at, you know, like right now, I'm looking at your brochure on your dry fly hackle, and you've got the natural colors, the dyed colors, and the new dyed colors there. Mm-hmm. As a consumer, does it make much difference to me where these capes came from, what lines, or has the quality evolved in all of them, and it's just you use the lines to get different colors and different patterns?
No, the lines are distinctly different, and some people prefer one line over another.
Okay.
And so it's different flavors. They both will tie excellent dry flies, both the Hoffman baseline or the Hebert Miner baseline. I have brought them all up genetically. If I hadn't done that, then I wouldn't be very good at my job. And so they're radically different than what I got from their original birds. And I keep samples of that just so I can kind of track my progress. People can tie excellent dry flies with either line. The Hoffman tends to have narrower saddles. We have 14-16 hook size predominantly, but we also have mid-size, which is 18 and narrower. The Hebert line, just to start with, had a larger saddle size, and it had a dry fly saddle as well when I acquired it. It wasn't as good as the Hoffman, but it's come along a great deal. And it tends to be larger, get a few 8s, but mostly 10s, 12s, and 14s. So it fills a different range of hook sizes. Some people really like natural duns. So if they like natural duns, we steer them towards the Hebert line because most of them are natural duns. While the Hoffman didn't have natural dun, we do a lot of dyeing dun, and some people are very happy with dyed dun, and it's very predictable, and the commercial fly tying companies like it because it's all the same dye recipe, and they have predictability of their product, and their flies look the same in the bins. So I wouldn't recommend, there's not a better one. One is not better over the other one. There are different price points. And the Hebert Miner tends to be lower in price point. It is lower in price point, so some people that are more cost conscious would go that direction. But both of them, people are happy with them both. We can't keep up with the demand on either one.
So it's more a matter of what your purpose is as to what you want to do, and then a little bit of personal preference and mixed.
Yes.
Well, I want to come back to that in a few minutes and talk very specifically about the different types of feathers and capes and so forth. But let's talk a little bit about the actual raising of the chickens so that we can get some background on that. What actually happens at the farm? You know, most of us are not in touch with raising chickens. I mean, most of us, you know, the closest we get is buying a package of chicken or a carton of eggs at the grocery store. So can you kind of give us in layman's terms what it takes to raise chickens?
Well, these chickens are radically different than your egg chickens or your meat chickens. Those are very, very large-scale operations. Like in this country alone, I think they harvest 185 million meat chickens a week. So it's vast. And the commercial egg business is all a very industrialized industry as well, and I have some experience in that, which was valuable for what I do now. The hackle business is very small. And it's, instead of large volume and small margin, hopefully it's large margin and small volume. And we have the breeding farm and the hens and mate, and with roosters and the hens mate, and we have incubators, and so we pull the chicks and they're pedigreed and then they're pampered. The one radical difference between the hackle business and all other poultry industries, and it's one of the reasons I'm in it, is you really have to work on pampering the birds. Because in order for them to realize their genetic potential to grow these great feathers, basically they've got to leave a very pampered life. Because anything you do that's not right, if their husbandry isn't right, or they get ill, or their nutrition is not proper, or their lighting program is not proper, or they're crowded, they won't grow good feathers. I know, because I've messed them up. And so one of the reasons the hackle is so expensive is you have to give them lots of room. You have to have very good environments. They have to have very good care. You almost take individual care of them. And on a large scale, that's fairly difficult. But anyway, we hatch out the chicks, and we brood them on the floor where it's nice, warm conditions, and usually start them off at about 95 degrees Fahrenheit. And at this point, they're basically ambulating embryos. They got their eyes open, and they have down on them, but they get around. You got to let them find the food and water, and you raise them up. But one of the frustrating things about hackle birds is the roosters will be roosters. And about 10 to 12 weeks of age, they start to fight. Roosters are very territorial. They don't like to be around other roosters. And if they have a chance, they'll do damage to them. And that does not work for if you're raising something for its feathers. So what we've evolved is a system where we raise them up, but before they really can do much damage to each other, we have to put them in individual cages. And if people's image of a small cage, they don't like that, they got to realize that the cages we have are quite large. If they were a commercial laying hen, say, they'd be probably 7-10 birds in it where we put one rooster. So they have plenty of room. They have their own feeders and waters. Every single cage does. And I have in my system right now, amongst the three production ranches, 60,000 individual rooster cages. That's a lot of cages. Everyone's got its own feeder, and everyone's got its own water, and then they're all environmentally controlled. And they spend a very long life, compared to most chickens, living in this cage as they grow their feathers. And they can hear each other, and they can see each other, but they can't get at each other. Otherwise, they'll hurt the very reason you're trying to raise them. And I've tried other things like red contact lenses and rather odd ideas like that, and nothing seems to work. The only way you can get a quality product is raise them in an individual cage. And all these mink cages I had to start with were different sizes and dimensions and configurations. All the mink guys were very independent. They all had their own idea about what was the right mink cages. Well, it ended up to be a kind of an inadvertent experiment on cage design, and I learned a lot from that. And so when I got to building just rooster barns that weren't mink barns but new rooster barns with cages in them, we'd kind of worked it out. So anyway, the birds are raised, and they're almost a year old when we harvest them, which is long for a chicken. A meat chicken is 35 to 45 days of age when it's harvested, so it's a fairly short life. But these hackle roosters get a nice, long, pampered life of about a year. And then we euthanize them to harvest the pelts. And we have to do that because people want to buy the pelt, the feathers on a pelt. And it's the only way you can keep control of it to dye it and wash it and process it. So that's what we do. So the operation, if people came to see it, and unfortunately we don't provide tours, just there'd be problems with doing that. I'd like to do it, but we just can't take the time or show people what we do. It's extensive. Like in my company, we have over 250,000 square foot of chicken barns. 250,000 square feet. That's a lot of birds. It's a lot of area and a lot of investment. And that's one of the reasons the hackle is so expensive, is you have to really pamper them. You have to have all this space. You have to have all the other things that go to support the equipment, the tractors and the trucks and the automatic feeding system, the feed bins and the processing equipment and the curing facilities and all that kind of stuff. So it's a surprisingly complex, involved process.
Tom, where do you get your feed? What, is this standard chicken feed that's just commercially available, or do you feed them differently?
No, we really don't feed them differently. It's just a very high-quality poultry ration that's based on corn and soybean meals and our vitamin mix and mineral mix and some other things we put in it. There's no magic bullet.
Okay.
Having some super feed is not going to make the feathers good. But on the other side, if you have poor-quality feed, that's another stressor to them, and it'll take away from them realizing their genetic potential. If they don't have the nutrients in the feed, they can't grow the feathers. And they'll have stress bars, or the feathers will be just brittle, or there's all kinds of problems that can result from having inadequate feed. But there's no super feed that'll make the feathers great.
Well, it sounds like what you really have is a pet chicken for a year. I mean,
yes.
You get the same care as you would if it was a pet.
And darn near. You know, Aunt Mabel's little banty hen might get a better treatment, but if I have to get resurrected or as a chicken, I'm going to want to come here.
Well, let's talk, because we do have a few questions, some that came in over the Internet while we've been talking here, about the genetic aspects of things. One question was, how long and how many generations does it take to get the desired product once a type of feather or cape is visualized? And this came from Robin Ryan McKinney, and she also asks, is there any DNA engineering foreseen?
Okay, those are good questions. First of all, any breeding program, you have to have a clear idea where the bird started, in this case a bird or whatever animal, domestic animal you're doing with it. You have to know where it came from. You obviously have to know where it is now. But more importantly, you have to have an image in your mind of where you want to take it. Because any breeding program, you look at many individuals, and this is largely a number game, you have to have a clear idea where you want to take it. So here it is and where you want to take it, and it's incremental. Every year you should be making progress. And so it depends on how far you've got to go to get it to it, how far it is to make that progress. The more highly developed the lines are, the more difficult it is to make progress. These hackle birds, which are now at a state where they've been worked on for 40 or 50 years, if you want to be a reductionist about it, are just sort of biological support units to extrude dry fly hackle. You want to be a reductionist about it anyway. And so the bird is having to grow something for you that it wouldn't want to do at all. And so there's genetic resistance for it wanting to do that. And so once the birds get very, very good, it's more and more difficult to make progress. And so that's why you have to have a controlled environment so they realize their genetic potential and you're not introducing environmentally induced variation or suppressing what they could do. So it takes many years, but it also depends on where the birds are, where they are, and where you want to take them. The other part of the question was DNA mapping and things. I've looked into that. It's been largely done since I've been out of graduate school, so I'm in the dark about it. And people that are in it and study it full time can't even keep up with the science. It's moving that fast. We don't do any DNA work. I do gene work. I can see genes in there, and I manipulate those by breeding methods, the old good tried and true what they call quantitative genetics, where you're dealing with population genetics, and then your qualitative genetics, which are like plumage color and whatnot. Those are the things I do and have sort of researched and stumbled on things that aren't even published in the literature, the scientific literature. So do you think that answers that question?
Yeah, I think so. Let's come back and explore a little bit more of that, but I do have to take a little break here, and then we'll do just that.
Okay.
Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and sport network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's Reeling, A-N-D, Healing, Midwest.org, or go to www.ifishon.org. That's the letter ifishon.org. Or call 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tom Whiting of Whiting Farms about hackle and feathers and the facts about the whole thing. So if you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box you see there. Send us your question, and we'll receive your question immediately. And we're trying to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Okay, one part that we didn't answer is how many generations it takes to see effect there, Tom. That was part of that question.
Well, you see effects in every generation if you're doing a proper genetics program. But to make any real material changes, it's 5 or 10 years. Some of the lines I've developed from scratch, like the American hackle or the spay hackle or some of those. In the case of the American hackle, I've been working on that for about 16 years, and now it's getting to the point where it's well accepted in the marketplace. And is so it's taken that long to form it and sculpt it into what fly tire is like. And I use fly tires in the process. I have a pro team that are very experienced, knowledgeable fly tires, and they're my sounding board, and I give them samples, and they tell me what's wrong with it or what I have to do to make it better and things like that. And that's some of the guidance that I rely on to direct the breeding program, and then I know how to affect it into a breeding program.
How many actual breeders do you have? Or do you keep certain roosters and hens for breeding purposes only?
Yes. Actually, I pull my breeders out of the production stock. I go through every single bird at harvest, and I know the lines well enough that the ones that are outstanding for their line or they're going in some direction I want to go, I flag, and then I do a very thorough scrutiny of their feathers. And if they make that gauntlet, which is like the top one half of 1%, then they get to get into the breeding house. And then they get put with hens that are also selected, but they have to be selected in a different way because some of the feathers are sex limited. You don't grow dry fly hackle on a hen, although some of the hens are getting awfully close to that at this point. And so we breed those breeders, and I was actually rearranging the breeder barn in preparation for installing a new breeder farm flock next week. And I'm constantly doing this, putting in a new breeding flock about every 12 weeks. So I have three or four breeding flocks going at any one time just to keep a steady flow of chicks into the system.
So then when those chickens make it to that level, they're they're in the retirement program, right? I mean, they're still working, but they're enjoying every minute of it, right?
Yeah, they're the lucky few, and they're outstanding. And considering the odds, I'm sure they're – if they could appreciate the fact, I'm sure they'd be appreciative.
Yeah. Okay, well, one of the questions is, let's see, I think we covered the genetic, the breeding. Mixtures of roosters and hens, is there a balance there that's kept? Is it 50-50 of the breeders, or do you have more roosters or more hens than roosters, or how does that work?
Well, fortunately, chickens are descended from the jungle fowl, which is a wild bird, and it's polygamous, meaning the roosters will mate with many hens, or as many as they can find, actually. But the proper in a poultry situation, you usually put 12 to 14 hens per rooster. And we do all of our mating in pens, so we keep the pedigree information going. And it depends on the line, how many I can put in the cage, and how many I want to produce. Usually no less than 10 hens per hen and up to 15 hens per rooster. But we also do a fair amount of artificial insemination. And the advantage of that is it's a more effective or efficient way to reproduce the birds. And instead of using one rooster for 10 to 15 hens, you can use one rooster for 50 hens because you use a semen diluent, which spreads it out, and you actually put it in the hen, so it's much more direct. And by doing that, you can use fewer roosters that are more superior and just get more bang for the buck off the hens that way. And in some cases, the demand's so high for some of those lines that it just makes sense from a dollar and cent point of view to do that. So we use a fair amount of artificial insemination.
We do have a question here from Gert in Belgium, in fact. He asked, well, how do you harvest the hackle? And I think you kind of answered that in that they're actually skinned, right?
Yes, and we do it all in-house. We have our own skinners, and actually for the first couple of years of Whiting Farms, I did all the skinning. And I sit down now and then just to reassure everyone that I could still do it. And they watch to see if I cut myself. But anyway, it's a rather precision bit of work where we use scalpels and things because the skin's fairly thin. And then we wash our pelts after we skin them or before we skin them sometimes. And that way we have nice clean feathers. And I think we're the only ones that do that on 100% of our pelts. I'm not too sure on that. And then we cure the pelts, and that's just air drying. It's not any kind of chemical preparation. I don't want to put chemicals on the feathers or on the skin because these are going to go in water somewhere, and fly tires are always sticking things in their mouths, so I don't want anything on the feathers. And so they're just washed in a nice biodegradable soap that we found works just fine, shines them up nicely. And then after they're cured, we trim them, which gets a little bit of the peripheral skin out of the way to make it look cleaner and make it a consumer pelt. And then we grade it, and then we package it, and we ship it.
No, and if it needs to be dyed, then it's dyed on premises as well?
Yes, we do all the dyeing. And dyeing of feathers is a surprisingly difficult thing. A lot of people try out using Rit dye or stovetop dye, and that works out all right. But when you're doing a large-scale thing, you want to make sure there's three things in place. One is, obviously, it's the right color. Secondly, it's dye fast, meaning the dye is locked into the feathers and it won't come out on your hands or in the water or on the packaging or anything like that. The third thing you want is that it's consistent, and that's where one of the real challenges is. So when you order medium done, it's pretty close every time you order it. So those are the three traits. And dyeing is kind of like cooking. There's certain people that are great cooks, and no matter what they touch, it works out fine. And there's some people that are hopeless cooking, and nothing they make is even edible. Well, I found dyers are the same way, the ones that dye pelts. And I was never very good at it, but I fortunately found some people that are good at it. And it's as much alchemy as it is chemistry. We control pH and the additives and all these kind of things. It's a little bit more taxing than you would think, but it's at a large scale. So it has to be that way.
And then, of course, the question that everybody wants to know is what happens with the chickens after you take the pelts off?
Yeah, that's a question. Anytime I give a slideshow, somebody always answers it. What we do is the chickens, because they're so old when we harvest them, the meat is very tough. know, that I said before, the meat chickens you buy in the grocery store are 35 to 40 days of age, something around that. So they're young and they're tender. As the birds get older, they lose moisture, natural process of aging, and the meat gets fairly tough. So by the time the roosters are a year old, it's pretty tough. There's no dog food or pet food manufacturers anywhere close, and frankly, there's not a lot of meat on these birds because I don't want them to have a lot of meat. They don't need a lot of meat. In fact, I breed them down in size whenever possible just because it's less carcass to deal with. So what we do is I have a farming and ranching operation as well as part of the company, and we take it out to the farm, all the carcasses, on a daily basis when we harvest, and we compost it, which is just mixing it with wood chips for a carbohydrate source and chicken manure for a nitrogen source and water. And it's like a huge rototiller type arrangement, and we compost it down into a soil amendment, which goes on to our agricultural fields as a, well, it's a fertilizer, and it improves the fertility of the soil. So at least we're doing something with it. I've never found any other thing to do with them. I wish I did, but that's the best alternative I've ever been able to come up with.
Well, it sounds like a good one to me. Goes back to the earth, and I take it you're raising some other crops or something out on the...
Yeah, we have quite a bit of agricultural. Well, it's a big farm.
Yeah, yeah. Now, has the avian flu affected your business at all?
Avian flu actually hasn't hit the United States, and so we haven't been subjected to any kind of risk, I think, there. The avian flu has caused us more export or import problems than anything. It's a very high-profile world issue, and it's endemic in some parts of the world, in Asia and other places, and it is a very serious consideration there, and it's wiped out huge populations of birds or chickens and waterfowl and other birds that can sort of come to it. I actually... one of the few people that have seen the disease, not because we've had it here, but when I was in graduate school, I went up with a group from the University of Georgia when avian influenza, a highly pathogenic form of it, H5N2, arrived in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And I went up with a group from the University of Georgia, and I was a member of the avian influenza task force, and this was in 1983. And I was on the wildlife division of that task force. Well, anyway, so I saw it firsthand, and it is a nightmare of agriculture. Absolutely. But that was 25 years ago or something like that, and they've learned a lot since then. And they're working on vaccines right now, and there's been other control methods, and it's been endemic in Asia for, 10 years. And only a small, relatively small number of people have died from it. It's under 200 that they've documented. And so even though that's tragic for those 200 compared to just regular flu, in this country,
yeah,
I think 16,000 die every year just from regular flu. So it's sort of in perspective. I'm very concerned with it.
Do you do anything to protect your stock?
Yes, we do. We have a fairly tight biosecurity system, meaning that we follow procedures to limit bringing in any pathogens into the operation. We fortunately have very healthy birds, and we do some just routine prophylactic vaccinations for basic poultry diseases just to make sure they're covered for. But we haven't had any health problems since the early 90s that I can even recall. And much of that is the fact that they're not stressed, because many of the poultry are, industrial animal diseases because they're stressed. They're, high-density production pushing to the limit.
Obviously, fly tires wouldn't have anything to worry about from feathers coming from your operation. Is there anything they need to be worried about imported feathers?
No, I don't believe there is, because flu, the viruses that cause this flu, or any kind of flu, don't last outside the human outside the body or the host for more than a couple hours under ideal conditions.
Okay.
And that's why flu always comes in the winter when everyone's coughing and sneezing on each other. So
yeah,
there's no
okay.
risk of fly tying materials. You're contracting avian influenza from fly tying materials.
Okay. Let's talk about the hackle.
Okay.
First of all, why don't you explain to the folks what a feather is? I read a bit of your material. I thought that was kind of interesting. Keep it brief, because after that I want you to get into the different types of hackle that you produce and the purposes of those. So.
Yes. Okay. I'm happy to do this. First of all, one of the fascinating facts about feathers are really what they are reptilian scales that have been greatly elongated and specialized because birds will evolve from reptiles or dinosaurs. And so that's what a feather is. It's like a scale, but it's obviously long and different shaped. It's a real evolutionary process. So that's what a feather is. And there's even residual scales on chickens, on their legs, on their shanks and feet. There's a little scale, and you can see that. And when you have a gene called the scaleless gene, and I've had that in my gene pool, which prevents, they're just in the skin, no scale, which is a follicle where the feather or a scale comes out of, is not present. It's a mutant gene. Then they don't have feathers and they don't have scales. And so you have a naked chicken. And I raised a few of those just for a lark. Anyway, so that's what a feather is. It's a highly elongated, specialized reptilian scale. That's what a feather is. And so it's staggering to think about the diversity in the bird world of feathers, like from a peacock tail to these chicken feathers to duck plumes. It's really a marvelous evolutionary thing, the feathers are. Now, the feathers that people buy for, say, dry fly hackle, they actually come off the head and the neck. That's usually called the cape. And these feathers start growing about where the eyeballs are or around their comb, that fleshy piece of that stands on top of the rooster head or hen head, and then goes down the back of the head and down the neck. And these have specific tract names that people probably wouldn't want to even know or remember, and I can't at this point either. I'm drawing a blank. Anyway, the feathers grow out of the neck and the saddle, and those are usually where the dry fly feathers come from.
And then that's on the neck and so forth. And then as Ken Calhoun here in Gilmer, Texas, he says, the difference between capes and saddles then from the where the neck ends begins the saddle, is that how?
It's almost continuous now, and that's one of my goals, to have dry fly hackle from their eyeballs to their tail. And there is a little patch in between the cape pelt and the saddle pelt that isn't that way yet, but it's getting darn close. And the thing that fly tires ought to know about is the cape, which is these feathers from the head and neck. Because they're starting at a small thing, their head, and going down their neck, they really vary in size in a continuous fashion. They start small and get larger. So a hobby tire, fly tire, is often better off with a cape because they have a full range of sizes going up and down this neck because the feathers change pretty significantly. We have the top of my capes on the breeder roosters are usable size 32s. And very few people actually tie a size 32, but that's my goal because I want to, you know, they're the leading edge of the genetic development of those lines. And one of the things I've done over the years is push the size range down the neck. So now at the base of the neck, it's maybe to size 8 or 6, maybe 4. So you see you have a huge range of sizes on a cape. On the main grades, like a bronze grade, you'll be strong from about size 20 to 10. So that's still a fairly significant size range. The saddle's a totally different animal. It's off the same animal, but it's sort of a different thing. Saddles, dry fly saddles, at least ours from Whiting Farms, usually have two predominant sizes on a saddle pelt. Like on the Hoffman, they're very often 14s and 16s. Then you'll have a few on the outside of that, a few 12s and a few 18s maybe. So it's usually only a two-size saddle. So if you're tying a narrow range of flies or a hook size, a narrow range of hook sizes, then you're much better off with the saddle because it'll be concentrated in the sizes you want to tie. And the commercial fly tying industry loves them because of that reason. They even buy them by size from us. So that's the difference between a cape and a saddle. Some people just like to play with the saddles. I find fly tires who will buy a whole range of saddles just to have the full range of sizes when they could have gotten it on a neck because they just like using saddle hackle. Some people buy necks. It's a personal choice as much as anything.
Okay. Now, I did, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about raising, but since it just came in on the Internet, I wanted to address it. Bruce in, looks like he's in B.C. He wanted to know when you cage raise those cockerels, how you protect the plumage. Is there anything special you do? He says, do you use a rail system like a breeder barn to keep them clean and unmarked?
No, the cages are smooth, and the roosters can't have at each other between the wire. so they have a solid partition between them. And this is no secret. All the hackle producers use the same thing. So they can't sit there and fuss with their neighbor all day and rough up their feathers. And if they're happy and content, they just kind of stand there and grow feathers.
Okay. Okay. All right. Talk about, because I'm looking at, and this can be quite confusing, I think, to folks, if I look at your quick reference guide to hackles, can you kind of break this into groups and then tell us, you know, as buyers of hackle, what we should be looking for? And I'm gonna have you think about that for just a second while we take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll dig into that deep, okay?
Okay.
Flats Time Charters is your sponsor for this segment of our show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, the Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. It's only a short drive from Orlando, and you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051, or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tom Whiting about hackle and feathers. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage and use that text box under Tom's section there and send us your question. We'll try to answer it on the show tonight. Okay, Tom, this quick reference guide, which has a lot on it for a quick reference guide, there's a lot of different kinds of hackle. Can you break that down for us?
I agree with you. It is a little bit confusing, and that's why we put together that quick reference guide to give a handle for a shop or an individual tire, just to sort of break it down. And I can break it down into several major categories, and one is dry fly hackle. And that's a big part of our business, is what the company was founded on. And so we talk about the different lines, the Whiting line that was derived from the Hoffman, the Heber Minor line, which was from Ted Hebert, and then we have a new one we put together called the Euro Hackle line, and I'm working on another one besides. But it's sort of on the quick reference guide, it gives like size ranges of the capes and size ranges of the saddles. And that's where, like, the Hoffmans I talked about, size 16 and 14 saddles, Hebers would be larger, and the Euro Hackle is even larger still, like 8s, 10s, and 12s, because there's a big need for larger size dry fly saddle hackle for wolf patterns and hexagena and variants and things like that. So the first big breakup is in dry fly. And we offer a pretty, well, the largest range of sizes, colors, and types of dry fly hackle in the world. The wet fly world is a whole different fishing world. And I set out to develop that in the early days because I thought to myself, you know, dry fly is really very limited streams certain times of year and only certain parts of the year. And, you know, that's a little bit thin bit of business to base a whole business enterprise on. So I developed wet fly lines, and I set out to do a wet fly, a streamer hackle, because people were asking me for it. And so I set out to do that. Now, it's a totally different feather, but the laws of genetics are the same, so I just apply those laws of genetics, and I have a different goal in mind, and I select in that direction and started with a different foundation stock. But anyway, that's a big, broad, stiff feather. It's not for wrapping. It can be used for wrapping in the saddles, but for the capes, which is the predominant pelt sold in that line, it's big, wide, and webby, as opposed to a dry fly, which is narrow, no web to it, and very flexible. So the wet fly and the dry fly are your major breakups. And I have one major wet fly line, and that's the American Hackle. We couldn't think of any better name, and one of our customers actually put that name on it, and we just went with it. But it's been developed as the first genetic wet fly hackle. I've also developed a spay hackle. And the reason I did that is because people, you know, for tying spay flies or different other Atlantic salmon or chinook or a bunch of other ones, wanted a sort of a hair-like feather. And instead of raising blue-eared pheasants or pheasant rumps or whatever other substitutes for the heron feather that the actual original spay hackle came from, I just wanted to do it on a chicken. And it is totally different. It looks like fur. The chickens are rather strange looking to boot. They look like cotton balls. Anyway, that's another line, and it's a small R&D line, but it's becoming more and more popular, especially in Scandinavia and the Atlantic salmon areas, and then some oddball places like people make spey poppers or schnook flies out of them. They're using a lot of new applications for those. So that's sort of what the quick reference guide is breaks down. It lists the fly you want to tie and tells you the alternatives and the product lines so you can choose which is the best for your tying intention.
Okay. Now, one of the questions, I guess this was, yeah, it looks like it came in here from a couple different people, but we have Tom Schilling, Thornton, Colorado. How do you go about grading the feathers? Is it by the quantity of feathers per pelt or quality per pelt or both? And what's the difference between platinum and silver?
Okay.
Your
good
grading
question.
System.
It is confusing. There's a couple aspects to it. We grade the capes and the saddles in a slightly different format, and it goes to your listener's question. The saddles mostly are quantity. First of all, there's no bad feathers. I don't think we produce a bad feather anymore. I hope we don't. We strive not to. But the saddles are long and linear, and they're all one size, so really what's the appropriate way to grade them is in quantity. And we figured it out on a cost per fly. And so a cost per fly for a saddle hackle from our company is less than 2 cents per fly if you do a normal hackle collar on it. So saddle grading is mostly just quantity. Now on the cape, which is the head and neck feathers, it's a little different measure. Its size range is one of the big things that people really seek out and are willing to pay for. Getting up to tiny usable feathers like size 22, 24, 26, up to 32, those are in the very top grades, and that's what a criteria is for like a platinum, or we have a few that are ultra platinum, and gold. They have to be strong in those small sizes, and then they're very, very generous in all the other sizes as well. The lower grade pelts, such as a bronze grade, which is kind of our standard grade, and it goes, you know, ultra platinum, platinum, gold, silver, and bronze. Those are the grades we sell, and most of the pelts we get are bronze, should be very strong from size 20 to 10, which covers most the range of most fly tires. So it's sort of anyone that's doing just basic fly tying will get a very good value for their money buying bronze. The quality is the same. The feathers might be shorter, and this is where the quantity calculation comes into a cape grading. It's not only the size range, but often on some of the higher grade pelts like gold and platinum, the feathers are 3, 4, 5 inches long, usable length, not web, usable length. So many of the feathers are 2, 3, and 4 fly feathers. They're almost getting like saddle hackle. So that's taken into the calculation on neck grading. So a quantity and a size range is really how we grade the capes. Bronze is good for almost all fly tires, and it's our standard grade.
Okay. Another question from Kevin Compton in Cleveland, Ohio. What are some of the differences between Whiting's Coque de Leon birds and those from Spain? How does the climate in Delta differ from Leon, and does that effect have any different, creating differences?
Well, this guy's knowledgeable.
I guess. I don't know.
that's good. Actually, I brought over the Coque de Leon birds from Spain in the early 90s, and I'm glad I did, because to do any kind of importation of poultry stocks anymore is more than a challenge, put it that way. Now, interestingly enough, and I've got a book that shows the climate and the region, a book on Coque de Leon, it looks a hell of a lot like Delta, Colorado, where we're at. It's very dry and arid. Now, I've talked to Spaniards, and I've read as much on the subject as I can, and they claim several things. It is the climate. The other thing is there's radioactivity in the soil. That was one of the reasons their feathers are so good. They don't know, though, but in Delta, they just west of here, there's a lot of uranium mines. It's one of the sources of the uranium. So we have radiation around here, too, is the iron. Maybe that's why they do well in Colorado. Anyway, the real difference is how we harvest the feathers. in Spain, they have a tradition where they pluck the feathers. And I've talked to people that have gone and actually seen it, and I've seen it in the books. It's like a little farmstead activity where a family will have a stable of roosters, so to speak, of, you know, 20 or 50 roosters. And then every 3 months, they go out, catch the roosters up. They're free-ranged out in the open. They wrestle them down, and the roosters probably know what's coming, so they probably hide or put up a pretty good fight. Anyway, they nestle them between their legs, and they pluck off, only a few feathers at a time, their shoulder feathers. And these are have the long, glassy, speckled feathers, which people use for tailing, which the Coq de Lion bird is so famous for. And they have to do it on the third phase of the moon, apparently, is what I've read. And I don't know what bearing that has on it, but it's part of their folklore. And they, the older they get, the better the feathers get. And so that's how they do it. Now, we don't do it here in Colorado that way. I brought over the birds, and I've been raising them now since the mid-1990s. And we don't pluck them. Although I've done that, they don't like it. They make a malicious ruckus when you do it. It's got to hurt them. And the Spaniards will take a poultice of olive oil and ash and sort of dress them because they got to put them outside and they don't want them, you know, to be, it's sort of a healing paste they put on it. Anyway, we harvest them like we do the other birds. And I've looked at our feathers and then I've bought or been given the best that I've seen out of Spain, and we're very close now to getting the same shoulder feathers. They're called the humeral track over the humerus bone, which is the first one on the wing, that the Spaniards are showing or selling. So I think our method is working all right. The other thing is, because I have many more generations and I can exert the selection pressure and have a breeding program over it, our saddles have gotten longer and our capes now are getting speckled in the capes, in the pardos, which means speckled. And so people are very pleased with that. And the hens, we sell a lot of Coq de Lion hens, which is this beautiful, very complex modeling, which looks like a grouse substitute is the best way I can describe it, but it's truly unique and has tawny shades of browns and grays and very intensely modeled. In fact, the wings look like a mini bustard. And I think that's where I sort of got it that way. The original Coq de Lion hens I got were basically black with a little badger in the hen in the necks, and they were so reproductive. They were very vigorous birds. I just started having so many hens I could select the hens, and now they're all speckled. And so that's a product line in and of itself. So the answer to the question is the climate's surprisingly similar, and that's just coincidence. But how we do it and how I've gone about it, somebody told me there's a contract out on me from Spain because we're doing probably, I don't know how many they're doing in Spain now, but we do quite a lot of them here in Colorado. It's a neat bird. They're truly beautiful.
Okay, now we got to move along here, Tom. Jason Lancaster asks, what makes an outstanding dry fly hackle, and what should I be looking for when I buy them, and also indications of poor hackle?
I think if he stays with our products, he's going to be happy. We make a point of putting out a quality product, and every year they get better, and we pass that on to the consumer. I'm not going to talk about my competitors. That's inappropriate for me to do, but
we may also have some listeners that are in other countries that may have not have access to your products and so forth, too. So
okay.
Any general rules of thumb of you know?
Well, if it doesn't look nice and glossy and shiny and it's not put up well, it's probably not been processed well. If you take any kind of – I encourage people to take it out of the package. Don't be afraid. We package all our products in Ziploc bags, with the idea that people should be taking them out to look at the feathers to see if it's the size range that suits their tying needs. If they're a beginner, don't think that you got to buy the top grades. Buy the bronze grade. You'll be very happy with that. That's our biggest seller. And if it smells bad, don't buy it. If it's got bugs in it, don't buy it. If it doesn't look glossy and clean and the packaging's not good, it's probably not going to be so great. It's surprisingly the quality range that's available out there. But we, to make a brand name, have always strived to wash our pels, do a professional dyeing, make sure they're clean, and we always, if there's any defect in them, we grade them down. And that's the best thing I can tell them.
Okay. Rick Wixton in Lexington, Ohio, asked, does the age of the hackle influence the quality of the fly being produced? I guess he's referring to how old your neck is, I would assume. Or
how old the rooster is.
Or the age of the rooster, I don't know. But maybe you could address both.
Okay. There used to be a great book called Herder's Catalog, and in there, there's a quote saying that actually back in the day when that was being written, which is, what, the 40s and the 50s, the good feathers only came off two-year-old roosters. So they had to molt their first nuptial plumage or rooster feathers, then the second ones came in were good. Well, that isn't the case anymore with genetic hackle. In fact, if you let them molt their first neck, the second is no good at all. It's sort of shocking. It's gone the other direction. So it's the first set of rooster feathers that they put on after the juvenile plumage that are the actual dry fly good rooster feathers that you want. So the rooster can't be over in a year old or you're going to lose your first growth of feathers. So that answers that question. Now, if a pelt has been properly maintained in storage under good conditions, it should last, should be good for years. I wouldn't leave it in the sunlight. I wouldn't let bugs or moths get on it in any way. And I wouldn't let it get exposed to any really excess dryness because the feathers can cook. And if they're exposed to too high of temperature, they might get brittle. So, but okay. Some people have given me pelts that are historic pelts. Henry gave me some, Ted Hebert. These things are 30, 40 years old, and they still tie perfectly good feathers. I'm very careful how I keep them, though. Snap-lidded plastic boxes.
So if kept properly, the feathers themselves don't get brittle? Or
they shouldn't.
Okay. One of the questions John French, Southern California, asked is, what's the best way to store that, since you were just talking about that? Plastic box, wooden box, cedar box, flat, hanging, you know, et cetera.
At the very minimum, leave them in their Ziploc bags. That's the best thing. It's to keeps the bugs out or moths if that's a problem in your area. You can also put them in plastic snap-lid boxes. That's what I prefer and what we keep our inventory in, just to make sure no bugs get in it. I also encourage fly tires, hobby tires, to have a lot of little boxes instead of one big box. So if they do get a bug into their fly tying materials that could come in from deer hair or other feathers or anything like that, you have less at risk. There's less chance for it to get through all your materials. So if you have little boxes, you're less at risk, and it's a little bit safer way to keep them. But snap lid, plastic, you know, they're available at any many places, is the best way to go. Don't leave them laying out. I've heard too many horror stories about the dogs getting it or the bugs getting into it or, you know, or the grandkids. You know, so don't do that.
Okay. And we had a couple of questions on pricing. I think you've kind of addressed that. I don't know if you want to. Brian Wagner in Aztec says, great hackle feathers, but holy cow, are they pricey. Why so much for a chicken that cost about $2 to raise? Well, it sounds like it costs more than $2 to raise.
Yeah, boy, I wish I could raise them for $2 at pace. That's tenfold under anyway. Actually,
yeah.
Because I put more feathers and longer feathers on them, the cost per fly, even if we've raised prices, has actually gone down over time. The saddles and the capes we're putting out now, it's a relative bargain. The commercial fly tying industry used to buy like the rejects or the damaged pelts. Now the commercial fly tying companies are insisting on like silver and bronze grade because they realize on a cost per fly, it's a better deal.
Yeah, yeah.
So over time it's expensive, but it's an investment, so put it in a box.
Yeah, and you kind of explained it when you're raising these roosters in solitary, so to speak, and not in big open pens. There's a lot of cost involved in that, and I don't think people realize that that's how they were raised. So,
a few people have come around. I've shown around. They're staggered by the investment. And there's no cheap way of doing it. No cheap way of doing it well.
Yeah. Let's talk in the last couple minutes here about the future, because we did get a couple of questions there. Ted Rosenkrantz in Newington, Connecticut. Currently, the nice long feathers from your saddles are good down to size 18. We'll be seeing saddles that will tie down to 24?
Actually, I've got lines that are doing 26s and 28s, and we called it super midge or micro hackle. But the funny thing is, on our sales to our fly tying companies, and if you talk to hook or fly manufacturers, size 20 is the last really large volume sales, and then it falls off a cliff. And we found that on our 100 packs. I used to offer 22s and 24s, and we had so few sales we discontinued them. I actually have in the gene pool going all the way up to like 28 saddle hackle.
Wow.
On the roosters, and that is really small. Never hit 32. 28
yeah.
is about as narrow as I see it. So that's in the future. If people want it, I'll put it out there. But if the 24s and that range didn't sell, they should buy a cape.
Yeah.
Because at the top of the cape, you'll have in the, say, silver and gold grade, you'll have plenty of long feathers that size.
Okay, we had a question come in here from Roy Moyer in Campbell River, B.C., Canada. Do you have a listing of the neck and saddle to hook size? I'm interested in buying the right hackles to make the flies, but I need to know what goes with what. And I think what he wants is this quick reference guide.
Yes.
Is that available on your website or anything? Or
it will be
shops?
Shortly. We're renovating the website now, and that's one of the first things we're going to put on it because that we got many questions, that, and that's why we put that together.
Yeah.
The shops wanted to have it there so when somebody came in, they could say, well, let's look at this thing. And it would tell them and guide them right there at the shop level.
Well, why don't you give out your website address at this point so that people can check there and look for this because it's a good reference guide.
Okay, the website is www.whitingfarms, just all small letters, no punctuation, .com. So whitingfarms.com. And we should be adding things to it on a regular basis in 2008.
Okay, a couple more questions here. Any chance you'll raise gamecocks so that we have more of an affordable source of feathers for cheeks on salmon flies, jacids, and so forth?
I think he's asking jungle cock. Is that, I assume that's
probably
what he's asking.
Yeah.
That might be in the works. We'll have to see in the future. I don't talk about new products because people always hound us for it until we got them ready to go out.
Okay. Steve Schweitzer, Berthoud, Colorado. What is the next genetic level for the Whiting dry fly line of feathers? Where are you taking the next bird line? What's left to improve on? An almost perfect feather. Well, there's a compliment for you.
Well, there's no... Well, thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate that. Actually, that's one of the fun things about this job is they'll never get good enough. I have some show pelts that I'll take to shows occasionally, and, you know, they're like 10-inch size 18s on the capes. And that's the fun thing. It's incrementally getting better, and I don't ever see any end to it. I've got birds in the gene pool that are growing dry fly hackle off the sides of their wings and down their thighs. There's some unusual things because they're such genetic extremes. It's just a fun thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. It's a lifelong incremental challenge, and I hope to do it for... I hope I got a few good years left in me.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Anything that is a challenge that you're really trying to meet right now that you can talk about?
Well, I'm trying to catch up with demand right now. We're short on especially the dry fly, but I've gone up markedly recently, and I'm going to try to fulfill that. I hate to not be able to sell product that people want. That's my biggest challenge right now is try to continue the increase of the production so I can meet demand.
Okay. And one final one here, Steve Schramm in Petaluma, I guess Petaluma, California, I expect.
Mm-hmm.
Can you discuss the development of the new Whiting bird fur product and its potential fly tying applications?
The bird fur is the spay hackle rooster saddles, and it's a long wispy, looks like hair, or some people use it for bucktail. It's a new product that's only in R&D, and it's out with the pro team members right now. It's also, people are sending us applications. We put it out there, and they're sending it back. Some people use it with hair stackers and combining colors. Some people use it, as expected, on Atlantic salmon flies. Some people are putting it on schnook flies. Some people put it on poppers, bass poppers. Some people are just using it as garnishment to dress up other type of flies. So it's on lefty deceivers. Some guy told me this morning, he called me up and wanted to, he'd been putting it on as a little additive to his deceivers. So it's sort of the fun thing about fly tires. They're very inventive. They're very resourceful. They pick up roadkill, for God's sake, you know, and they find flies that they can make out of it. So this is a product that I developed, and now it's out there, and people are telling us how to use it. So
great.
It's available in goods in good quantities.
He also asked about knowing of shops in Northern California that currently stock your product. Can you answer that question in general on how people can find out where they can get whiting products?
On the website, by state, they list all of our active shops that we sell to. And
okay.
And then just click on the state is, I believe, the way it works, and then they can see where it is. But most fly shops that have a good tying department, fly tying department, should have our products. If they don't, you can request it, and we can try to get it to them.
Okay. And last question here, Jeff Wilkins in North Carolina. Tom, thanks for the great products you provide to the fly tying community. I was wondering about the Pro Tire program at Whiting and how you get involved in that. I'm a commercial tire and a fly fishing outfitter and tie at many of the shows.
I'd have to, right now I think our pro team roster is full. I think we keep it at 100 or 120, something like that. Believe it or not, I'm not managing that. Our sales and marketing manager actually manages that at the moment, BJ Lester. And it's something that's an invited. We seek out people that are good demo tires or good educators are a good team, that they give me good input and go out and do educational things. And I'd have to refer that to her, and maybe he can send an email to Whiting Farms. There's a link there on our website where they communicate directly with us, and he can communicate with the sales and marketing manager here.
Okay, great. Okay, well, we need to wind things up. Unfortunately, we're out of time here, but stick with us here, folks. We're going to give away the membership to the Fly Federation, subscription to the Fly Fusion magazine, and also that cape from Whiting Farms. So stick with us for another couple minutes. We're running a little late here, but we'll wind up rather quickly. So I'll be back to you in a few minutes, Tom, okay?
Okay, great. Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity, Roger.
Sure. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. And they also provide walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. It's located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com, or call 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Okay, well, let's get to these giveaways tonight, and just a quick reminder to everyone that's listening tonight live. Please go to our homepage right there in Tom's section and leave your comments before you leave the site tonight. We'd sure appreciate knowing how you felt and your feelings and your comments about the show. So, it's time to give away the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And that winner will be Tom Zimina, I guess, in Ohio. So, Tom, congratulations. You got a 3-year membership. The Federation of Fly Fishers. I'll be emailing you for your information so that we can get that information up to the Federation. Always a great prize. Now we'll pick the winner for the Fly Fusion magazine. It's a 1-year subscription. And let's see here. That would be Tim Magnum. Tim Magnum in Washington. Magrum, I'm sorry. I always mispronounce people's names. Tim Magrum wins the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So congratulations to both of you. And now, and by the way, to qualify for these drawings, you have to fill out our registration for the drawings ahead of the show time or during the show. And if you don't, by the time we do the drawing, it's too late. So do that for the next show and make sure you're in the mix for these drawings. We're always giving away great prizes. And now we're going to give away a Hebert Minor gold grade brown rooster cape from Whiting Farms. Quite a nice gift that Tom has offered up from Whiting Farms. And we need to come up with a question here. One that comes to mind is kind of an unusual one, but the feathers on a bird originally came from what? From their past history. What did the, or what are they actually a genetic modification of that used to exist on animals prior to the birds? So put your question or your answer into our text box and answer the question on the front page of our website. And the first person answering the question will be Win the Neck. So I'm checking now for answers. Here we go. We got a winner, I think. Tom, what's I've got an answer here. It says reptilian scales. Is that the correct answer?
That's right. Correct.
That's it. So Robin Ryan McKinney in Texas has won that cape. Robin, you'll need to either put your email address in that text box and send it to me again so that I can contact you and get your information so that Tom can get that cape to you. And I'm sure you'll enjoy using those feathers off that cape. So, hey, Tom, thanks for offering that to our folks tonight. That was great of you to do. And
Thanks
so much for being with us, and we appreciate your time, and it was an absolute pleasure to talk with you tonight.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I thoroughly enjoyed it, Roger.
Yeah, it was. I sure learned a lot, and I know our listeners learned a lot, and that's what it's all about. So thanks again, and we'll hopefully look for better and better feathers, because that seems to be your goal, and that's something that we can always look forward to in the future. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our next broadcast will be on December 5th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we'll interview John Barr. And our topic for the show will be fly tying and fishing with John Barr. John Barr designed the Copper John, the Barr Emerger, and many other successful fly patterns. So you're going to learn from John how to tie these flies and how to fish these incredibly successful patterns. If you don't use them now, you will by the end of the show. We'd like to thank Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Reeling and Healing Midwest, Flats Time Charters, and the Royal Gorge Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future shows. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.